Hello, this is episode 112 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast. I'm Andrew Kleiman, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. In the main segment of this episode, I'll be joined by Francisco, one name like Madonna, Bono. He'll be interviewing me about my new article, Marx's Critique of Daremon in the Grundrisse. The article's about one of Marx's most in-depth critiques of Proudhonism, the doctrines of Proudhon. Daremon was a big deal Proudhonist, and the Grundrisse, which Marx wrote in 1857 and 58, starts off with a 60-page critique of Daremon. There's a lot to talk about in the second half of Francisco's interview with me. We'll be talking about Marx's discussion of labor money and indirectly versus directly social labor. But in the first half, which you'll be listening to in this episode, we talk about everything else, what Proudhonism was all about, why it concerned Marx, why he fought it, and a really big issue, what is possible in a capitalist society and what's not? In what ways and to what extent can it be different from what it currently is? That's a key topic that Marx was dealing with in his critique of Daremon. But before that interview, we're going to have this episode's current events segment. I'll be joined by regular co-host Gabriel Donnelly, and we'll be talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last week to delay justice by agreeing to hear Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from prosecution. Please visit MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, the website of Marxist Humanist Initiative, to listen to past episodes of this podcast series, to learn more about the issues discussed in them, to post comments, and to provide Radio Free Humanity with much-needed donations. This podcast series is sponsored and hosted by Marxist Humanist Initiative, but the views expressed by hosts and guests are our own. They don't necessarily reflect the views or positions of MHI. On Sunday, March 17, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, MHI will be holding a Zoom meeting on the recent women's movement in Iran. It's open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI, ask to be invited. Next up is going to be Gabriel Donnelly and I on the SCOTUS decision to hear Donald Trump's argument regarding immunity.
Hello, everybody out there in listener land. We're coming at you from Sunday, March the 3rd, 2024. And as always, we're going to start the episode off with a little bit of current events. I am Gabriel Donnelly, the regular co-host, and I'm here with Andrew Kleiman. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. How's it going, Gabriel?
It's going. How about you?
I'm hanging in there.
So today we wanted to talk again about more of Trump's legal troubles and woes. There have been more updates and news down the pike since the last time we discussed it with the Engorand decision. So I think first we wanted to talk about the SCOTUS decision, that they are going to hear Trump's arguments about executive immunity. And they're going to hear it over the course of 5 days, late in April. But what really matters about that decision is that it delays the trial from going on, which is exactly what Trump wanted. He wanted to delay, and not have decisions coming down or trials that potentially not go his way happening during the height of election season. And this was a win for him. At least that's what is being reported at. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, I think that it's a huge win. And I was watching MSNBC when the decision came down, and all these legal experts were like white-faced. They were like in shock, even though I don't think they were surprised. It was just like, okay, this is the end of American democracy. The fix is in, and they're doing everything they can to let him get away with it, and it's working.
I said to you, Andrew, when we were planning what we talk about, that I really had a lot to say about SCOTUS. And I do, because I hope the listeners out there And I know there are a bunch of you who have a tendency to roll their eyes at our current events section and would say that we spend too much time worrying about Trumpism and it's all bad because it's all bourgeois liberal governance and so on. And what else can you expect from the Supreme Court? It's always weighted against the working class. All of those lines that are true, of course, that not that we focus too much on Trumpism, but that the Supreme Court is an undemocratic institution. But I hope those listeners are listening to me when I say the level of flagrance and disregard for any procedure, for any respect to democratic norms, is exceptional and is worth observing and being alarmed by. We have Clarence Thomas, whose wife is an insurrectionist. We know she was rooting on January 6th. We've had legal experts say he should recuse himself from cases involving him. He doesn't. We have a Supreme Court where they had a decision recently about the Texas border, who has authority over it, Texas or the federal government, and it was very close. You had four judges on the Supreme Court, the federal justice system, saying, "Eh, maybe a federal government doesn't need to exist." Right? It's a level of madness that we really should stop and look at, and it's not liberal derangement or Trump derangement syndrome. It's a real sober reckoning with how flagrant any regard for the rule of law has become.
And not only flagrant, what they're doing is more extreme, much more extreme than what we had before. You can say, oh, well, everybody knows the courts are bourgeois and all the other stuff that you talked about. The fact of the matter is, things were not like this not so long ago. Not so long ago, there was Roe v. Wade. Not so long ago, the courts were not intervening to rig elections in this manner. What explains that? What is the nature of the change and what are the consequences for us? And this line is what would you expect from the bourgeois system would tell us we would always be in a crisis like this? No, this is not normal. Let me just say before we go on, this decision by the Supreme Court to hear this case, to take until April 22nd to hear it, and then God knows when to issue a ruling. What is galling about this is it's a baseless case to start with. It makes no sense. And everybody has explained why. If he has the right to do whatever he wants as president, unless he's impeached by and convicted by the Senate, he could order everybody locked up and shot so that he would never be convicted by the Senate. It makes absolutely no sense. And the prior rulings that have come down have said this makes absolutely no sense. And there was a very well-argued, thoroughly researched opinion from the DC court. It's an open and shut case, and the Supreme Court sort of just said, yeah, they did it right. They did it well. We're not going to hear this nonsense. All this was a gift to Trump to delay this thing. So it's likely that he won't go to trial in DC until after the election. And then if he gets into power, that means never.
And we're now facing not just sympathetic justices and federal judges to creeping authoritarianism and Trumpism, but the people who do get slapped on the wrist are martyrs. People who get sent away for Trump, like the January 6th insurrectionists, are now martyrs and they were unjustly persecuted. It was a witch hunt against them. And they're getting very light sentences overall, too, in many cases for what they did. And all of this was maybe too late. All of the legal reckoning for Trumpism has become a big opportunity for rallying and delaying any justice and using it as an excuse to say, I'm so persecuted, I'm so persecuted.
Yeah, I mean, there's too late, I think, in a couple of senses. First of all, at the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland screwed up or had no choice but to screw up because of people who were not really wanting to get Trump involved in the FBI and so forth. But what we have now is, as a result of 20, 30 years, we got these right-wing judges everywhere, and they've got a lot of power in the Senate and the House. it wasn't so threatening when the Republicans were just a conservative party. When they are basically a fascist party, it takes on a different cast. So every day I tell myself, we're in a situation of dual power in this country. There is already, in some forms, a civil war going on. So in that sense, it's all really too late. It's not like we can stop this. It's like we're in the midst of it already.
And that in many cases too, Andrew, as I'm sure you know, deliberate and calculated. I mean, Steve Bannon used the phrase dual power, let's fight for dual power many times. And he encouraged Trumpists on a rank and file level, the mass space, to run for local office, get involved in local GOP positions, fill those levers of power on a small level so that there wouldn't be people anymore in those positions who would say no when orders came down. And he described that as creating dual power, you know, get into school boards, get into party positions, get into county positions, and be intransigent, be Trumpist.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. I had read that, but it was not in the front of my head.
We've discussed on a prior current event segment that it's not just enough, and it never truly was enough to count on institutional roadblocks preventing this. It always, the struggle against Trumpism always had to be a positive struggle for democracy and for truth. And to that, I can only say now more than ever, because courts won't do it, elections won't be enough, because even if he is resoundingly defeated at the ballot box, he successfully and his project has successfully casted doubt enough on elections that there will always be a question. A complete defeat of this is a mass positive movement for truth and democracy with a mass base. And there's a lot of elements in the Democratic Party who have no interest in seeing that happen or don't seem to because they're not working to make that happen. And I don't know why they're not, because they're going to be the first ones rounded up if rounding up starts. And again, to those listeners who might say, well, what does this inter-bourgeois fighting have to do with people on the ground? Look to the red states, look to the blue states, and look at how working class people all over this country are being subjected to misery that the Trumpists have set in motion and that have yet to be defeated and continue to be emboldened. And these people will not stop inflicting misery until they are stopped.
Absolutely right. This episode's main segment will be coming up in just a few minutes, but first, a word from our sponsoring organization, Marxist Humanist Initiative. Here is the organizational secretary of MHI, Anne Jacquard, talking about who we are.
This is Anne Jacquard from Marxist Humanist Initiative, or MHI. MHI aims to contribute to the transformation of this capitalist world by projecting, developing, and concretizing the philosophy of Karl Marx and its further development in the Marxist humanism articulated by Raya Dunayevskaya. Today, amidst many wars, climate crises, economic, social, and political crises, is a moment to engage people in discussion of these ideas. In the US, we're faced with the threat of Trumpism triumphing in all-out authoritarianism, extinguishing our right even to carry on such discussions. MHI is dedicated to the task of proving theoretically that an alternative to capitalism is possible. We are distinguished by our economic analyses, in which we do not merely assert but demonstrate that the only opposite to the current world economic system is its abolition and replacement with one not based on the production of, quote, value, close quote. Because capitalism cannot be fundamentally reformed, attempts to reform it lead to an intensification of state capitalism and not to socialism. We are not a political party, nor are we trying to lead the masses who will form their own organizations and whose emancipation must be their own act. But we have seen that spontaneous actions alone are insufficient to usher in a new society. We seek a new unity of philosophy and organization in which mass movements striving for freedom lay hold of Marx's philosophy of revolution and recreate society on its basis. Our ideas and actions, as well as our structure and rules, are guarded by the interests of working people and freedom movements of people of color, LGBTQ people, other minorities, women, youth, and all those around the world who are struggling for self-determination in order to freely develop their own human natures. We have no interests separate and apart from theirs. To this end, we open our website and podcast to the widest possible dialogue with people around the world. We intend to practice as well as to espouse a two-way road between our organization and people outside it as essential to developing a single dialectic in the relationship of theory to practice and as a way to assure the survival of Marxist humanism. Our collective is working to create an organization so firmly rooted in its philosophy that it will not succumb to diversions that may arise from personal agendas, and that will be capable of developing and concretizing the philosophy over the long haul, regardless of who its members may be. It is no simple matter to create a democratic organization that is at the same time effective and able to resist efforts to divert it from its goals. We are aware that Marx never achieved an organization based on his philosophy, and that Dostoevskaya's organization disintegrated following her death. But we have made progress in this matter with our principles and bylaws, and by recognizing that Marxist humanism cannot be carried on by chance or by individuals alone. An organization is needed in order to test and prove ideas. We invite all of you to join us in this discussion and our initiative.
That was Andrew Clard, the organizational secretary of Marxist Humanist Initiative, the organization that sponsors this podcast series, talking about who we are. This is the recording on March 2, 2024. With me is Francisco, and what we're going to be talking about in this episode, and we're going to continue in future episode as well, is a new article of mine that's just appeared in With Sober Senses, and its title is Marx's Critique of Dariamon in the Grundrisse, and the subtitle is On Indirectly Social Labor and the, quote, impossible tasks, close quote, of labor money. And I'm very pleased that Francisco has taken the time to read the article, to write up some questions, and to discuss all of this with me. And I'm pleased that he's interested in these issues, and I've got somebody to talk with about them in some depth. So welcome, Francisco.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me. So your article, it has a lot of subjects. It touches a lot of points. So just before we jump into that, let me ask you a few general questions so that maybe, you know, on one hand, we can help the listeners and we can get into context. Can you tell us what the word Grundrisse means? And can you tell us how come it's called that way?
Grundrisse is mostly an architectural term, but with regard to writings, it would mean something like outlines or sketches. In architecture, it refers to floor plans. Marx didn't give it that name. He didn't give it any name. These were just notebooks that he left. And the name Grundrisse was the name that archivists gave it in the 1920s when they were working with these notebooks and trying to develop them into something publishable.
And it does have a subtitle in English, right?
Yeah. If you're working from the Penguin edition or the Vintage edition, it's called Grundrisse Foundations of the Critique of Political Economy. And when the archivist began to work with these manuscripts, that was the full title, Grundrisse for the, you know, Critique of Political Economy. So you've got The Grundrisse of the Critique of Political Economy. You've got the book that Marx published a couple of years later, Contributions to a Critique of Political Economy. That's the title he gave it. And then in 1867, Capital, a Critique of Political Economy. So everything sort of has the same subtitle here. This is all about the same thing.
When were these notebooks written?
1857 and 1858. The Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy that Marx did publish comes out in 1859. First edition of Capital, Volume 1, comes out 1867. The Critique of Dariman was written at the end of 1857.
And we can locate this as a moment in Marx's intellectual development, right?
At least the moment of his development of his overall critique of Proudhonism, yeah. Marx's first extended critique of Proudhonism was The Poverty of Philosophy. That came out in 1847, right after Pierre-Joseph Proudhon came out with a book that is often referred to as The Philosophy of Poverty. Marx answered it like immediately with The Poverty of Philosophy. So that was 1847. Now we're talking about a decade later, 1857, we've got this critique of Dariman. Dariman was main honcho, big follower of Proudhon, his secretary, at least at that period before his political allegiances changed. Then you get subsequent critiques of Proudhonism and related tendencies in the Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, in Capital, in the Marxist 1875 critique of the Gotha Program. So this critique of Proudhonism is not an isolated thing for Marx. It really is there for several decades.
Just so that we can locate this critique, where is it in the Grundrisse?
It's right at the start. That's what he begins with. Now, if you open your book, you're not going to get that. You're going to get, like, here's a foreword from the translator, and then there's an introduction to the Grundrisse. And that's about 30 pages long or something. But when you get to the main body of the Grundrisse, there are two chapters. The first is on money. The second is on capital. So in the first of the chapters on money, that begins with a critique of Dariman. And that critique takes up about half, I would say, of the chapter on money.
We're going to talk about this later, but you can also find within that introduction what is commonly known as the method of political economy, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what your article is about and how it is structured?
I have to do a bunch of things in the article just to set the stage. So I talk a bit about how the critique of Dariman fits into Marx's overall critique of Proudhonism. And then I say a bit about who Proudhon was, what his ideas were, what his influence was, and why Marx found that so concerning, right? Because he's spending a lot of time over many decades combating this stuff. And then I go into rather brief overview of the whole of this critique of Dariman in the Grundrisse. And then I have three sections that look at aspects of this critique of Dariman in the Grundrisse that I think are particularly important on the issue of what is and isn't economically possible, on labor money, so-called, and on indirectly and directly social labor. Finally, there's an appendix where I provide a pretty detailed outline of this whole of the critique of Dariman, 60 pages of text. And I break it down into themes or passages, and there's about two dozen of them. And so I go through the text that way, providing little summaries.
So you, in a certain way, your article would also help anybody who needs to read this section on Dariman. They can go to your article and use that as a guide.
Yeah, and I think it would be helpful, particularly for people who really want to understand the start of the critique of Dariman, which is really in the weeds. It's a very technical discussion of metallic standard, you know, like a gold standard or bimetallic standard, gold and silver, and Dariman's criticisms of it and Marx's responses. This is hard even for me, and I've taught money and banking. It's hard even for me because, first of all, this is an unpublished text of Marx's, but also this is a kind of monetary system that doesn't exist, that we're not familiar with anymore. what I'm able to kind of summarize regarding how the text flows concerning these issues of the operation of the metallic standard, that might be helpful in particular. The big honcho commentators, most of, on the Grundrisse, most of them have like no background in economics, and they're hit with this like really technical discussion of the Bank of France's asset portfolio in the year 1855, and they're like, what the hell is this? You know, I'm Tony Negri. Well, I got to say something about this. So they say something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very common to not get a lot of content, just superficial readings. Your article lists four reasons why Marx's critique of Daremon is important. Can you tell the listeners what those four reasons are?
Yeah, and important really here means important as like a moment in this overall critique of Proudhonism that Marx is engaged with for three decades. I mean, there are particular issues that I think are like important for us today and so forth. But what I'm trying to get at there is basically the fact that like, hey, Marx had already critiqued Proudhon himself in The Poverty of Philosophy in 1847. So like, why should we even care about this critique of Daremon? That's what I'm trying to get at in that discussion. There's four reasons, I think. First, this critique of Daremon is one of the more in-depth discussions of Proudhonism that Marx engages in. The other really extended one is this Poverty of Philosophy. And second, the critique of Daremon is a further development of the critique of Proudhonism, even where Marx is talking about something he also talked about in The Poverty of Philosophy. The critique of Daremon doesn't merely repeat what he had said a decade before. The arguments are more fleshed out in the critique of Daremon, more precise than what was there in The Poverty of Philosophy. Third, then there's a lot that is new in the critique of Daremon that just was not in The Poverty of Philosophy at all. And that's mostly because Poverty of Philosophy is responding to a very wide-ranging book, so Marx's response is very wide-ranging. Daremon's book is about money and the metallic standard and so forth, and so that's what Marx is getting into in the critique of Daremon. So there are two very different critiques. They're not contradictory, but they're on mostly different topics. And then there's a lot of stuff in this critique of Daremon that anticipate and reappear in later works by Marx. Some of these things are about money just in general, and some of them are specifically about Proudhonism or especially about Proudhonism.
There's also the fact that what's new, or a lot of what's new in Daremon, which wasn't present in previous Proudhonism, is due to a historical event.
When Marx writes The Poverty of Philosophy, that's 1847. Then you get the revolutions of 1848, the next year. And in response to the revolutions of 1848, after that point, Proudhon comes out with something new that he hadn't come out with before. And that's this call for free credit. What that means is interest-free credit, zero interest credit. And along with that, he's calling for a bank of exchange to provide that kind of credit and to just regulate the monetary system and the credit system. So that was all new. Marx didn't get into that in The Poverty of Philosophy because Proudhon hadn't come out with that. But Daremon's book is all really about that, because what Daremon is saying is we need this free credit. What's preventing the free credit is the metallic standard. The gold standard in Britain, the bimetal gold-silver standard in France. So we've got this liquidity crisis, there's a shortage of cash, and the central banks, Bank of England, Bank of France, they're impotent. And what makes them impotent is this damn metallic standard. They got to hold metal reserves.
Your article as well points out that at least five of the arguments and themes within the critique are further developed by Marx in his later writings. Can you tell us what these are?
There might be more. I isolated five, more or less came to mind. One is the idea that money is just a further development of the contradiction that's present in every commodity between value and use value. He doesn't say it quite that way there, but that idea is there, right there, smack between two quotations from newspapers, right there in the Critique of Daruma. There's a long discussion in the Critique of Daruma of so-called labor money, and that anticipates discussion of labor money in the Contribution and Critique of Political Economy. And the Critique of Daruma develops this idea that capitalist society replaces the subordination of some people to other people with a universal subordination of people to things. That reappears in the section on the fetishism of the commodity in Chapter 1 of Capital. Fourth, the concepts of directly and indirectly social labor are developed first in this Critique of Daruma, and then they appear in Contribution to the Critique, Capital, Critique of the Gotha Program. Marx makes an analogy in this Critique of Daruma, comparing the kind of exchange system that the Proudhonists want to Catholicism, in which all Catholics are Pope. So he says the kind of exchange system you want is like so impossible would be like Catholicism, in which all the Catholics are Pope. The same analogy appears twice in Volume 1 of Capital.
It's clear that this critique is not so much against Proudhon or Daruma themselves, but Proudhonism and its recurrent MO. Let's start talking about Proudhon, the person. Can you tell us who he was and what economic system did he advocate?
Yeah, and I'm not going to be talking about some of his more unsavory ideas like, virulent anti-Semitism and anti-woman. Let's talk about the things that are really connected to Proudhonism as such. So, yeah, Proudhon was French. He was a worker. He was a radical thinker. He espoused anarchism, as he called it, meaning the absence of centralized government. And he espoused what he called mutualism, which is basically economic coordination through a network of workers' associations. He wanted an economic system that retained some features of market capitalism, but not others. He wanted to retain exchanges between individuals, contractual rights and obligations, but what he wanted would differ from actual market capitalism because the exchanges would be equivalent. Products of equal value, as determined by labor time, they would exchange one for one. So a product that took 8 hours to produce would exchange for another product that took 8 hours to produce. He soon thereafter began to advocate free credit, zero interest credit, and the establishment of a bank of exchange in association with that.
Marx and Proudhon knew each other personally to the point that Marx originally praised him, but then they took different positions progressively. Would you tell us a little bit on that?
Yeah, this was all happening in a very short period of time. I mean, they were never like identical twins to begin with. But when Marx was living in Paris, basically 1844, a little bit before then, a little bit after then, he and Proudhon evidently had long and friendly conversations talking into the night about economic issues. The evidence seems to suggest that there was always differences between them and their outlook and so forth, but that it wasn't clear at that point that the differences that they had were irreconcilable. What kind of made it clear that they were irreconcilable was Proudhon's publication of his book, The Philosophy of Poverty. So that is 1846. So this is all happening over a really short period of time.
He's mentioned that Proudhon identified as an anarchist. Would you tell us a little bit about Proudhon's relationship to anarchism and other anarchists?
Anarchism had been considered a dirty word, and he's like the first person of any kind of standing to say, yes, I'm an anarchist. And it was because of his opposition to centralized government, wanting workers' associations decentralized to coordinate and run things. But he was a huge influence on later anarchists, on Kropotkin, on Bakunin, big influence on syndicalism in France and Spain and so forth.
A large section of the international was Proudhonist, right?
Yeah, the First International. If they weren't all Proudhonists in the French section, at least the Proudhonists were dominant. And the French section was a big part of the international, maybe about a third of the voting members. So Proudhonism had a big, big presence and influence in at least the early days of the international, from around 1864 to around 1868. And then its influence wanes, and then you get another big struggle in the international.
Just about any anarchist, and sometimes even Marxists, will tell you that the falling apart between Proudhon and Marx was a matter of Marx being an authoritarian who wanted complete control. But you argue strongly against this interpretation.
You got anarchism and mutualism in general, but then it's important to be clear about political implications of Proudhon's specific version of anarchism and mutualism. The political implications were really harmful. The popularity, the influence of Proudhonism made this a real issue. You know, somebody can have bad ideas, but you know, you can let it slide if they don't have influence. But when they've got a big influence in the organization and they're steering it in the wrong direction, then that's a reason for concern. But it's about these ideas. What were some of these political implications of the Proudhonist version of anarchism and mutualism? People don't tend to talk about that too much. Well, they were against strikes by workers. They were against a legal limit to the length of the workday. They were against other laws that would improve workers' lives. They were against public education. They were against the independence of Poland from Russia. And they were against condemning czarism. And all of this comes from Proudhon himself and his version of anarchism and mutualism and his followers after his death, his followers in the international. This is the politics that they're pursuing within the international. So Marx had to fight this stuff again and again and again over a matter of years. Him fighting back against it, that's the main source of these allegations that he was an authoritarian who wanted complete control over the international. He explained the fight back very differently. He wrote a letter to his friend Ludwig Kugelmann. This was in 1866. He starts describing some of the Proudhonists' political positions, and then he writes, "Proudhon has done enormous harm. His pseudo-critique and pseudo-confrontation with the utopians seized hold of and corrupted the students, then the workers, especially those in Paris." So given the evidence of what these people were advocating and the importance of these issues and their really bad positions on them, and what Marx himself wrote at the time, it seems pretty clear to me that the fight in the international and Marx's strong opposition to Proudhonism were about the harm that Proudhonism could do and was doing. So when you get these commentators chalking it all up to Marx's supposed intolerance or desire for control, I think this says more about their own dismissiveness of ideas and the importance of ideas than it says about the historical record.
Can you explain Derriman's arguments regarding the monetary crisis?
There were monetary crises at the time. Derriman's writing in 1856, in particular, a shortage of cash, liquidity crisis in Britain and France. Derriman says that the cause of this liquidity crisis is the metallic standard. Gold standard in Britain, gold and silver in France. Derriman says if these countries went off of the metallic standard, then the lending by the central banks wouldn't be tightly constrained by the amount of metal that they held in reserves and that they had to hold in reserves under a metallic money system. If that were the case, then the banks would be able to do what the Proudhonists wanted, extend free credit. Zero interest credit. That would provide borrowers with cash. So that would cure the shortage of cash and help out with the underlying economic crisis in the non-monetary sector of the economy.
And Marx even mentions that even in those situations, the power of the banks was really limited, that Derriman gave the banks more power than they really had.
We get this even today in a somewhat different form, like you'll hear, like the Federal Reserve controls interest rates, et cetera, et cetera. Marx says, look, when things are going well, the central banks don't even really have anything to do with it. There's private lenders. It's only when the private lenders stop lending, when you're already in a crisis, that's the only time that it kicks in that the central banks have any power at all by offering essentially lower interest rates than the private lenders are offering. So if everything's going okay and the private lenders are lending at reasonable rates, then the central bank really has no role to play at all. So it's only at times when there's a crisis and its powers are extraordinarily limited that the central banks can do anything at all.
Regarding all of this theory, Marx says that, and I'm quoting him, Daimon and other Proudhonists don't even raise in its pure form the essential question. What is that question?
To answer this, let me back up a bit. Marx doesn't totally reject everything that Daimon says. He accepts that the metallic standard can aggravate monetary crises. And he even suggests that a different monetary regime may be able to eliminate some kinds of monetary crises that a metallic money system can't eliminate. But this, what he calls fundamental question, that's what they don't ever raise in its pure form. And it's a question of, would the underlying problems that generate some specific kinds of monetary crises under the metallic standard, would they just generate different kinds of monetary crises under an alternative money regime? Okay, so for Marx, that's the fundamental question. If we go off the gold standard, the gold and silver standard, would that do away with all monetary crises, or would they reappear in a different form under a different money regime? To him, that's the fundamental question here. Daimon and Proudhon, and they don't even raise this as such.
We don't have a metallic standard anymore.
Right. And we still have financial crises. We still have shortages of cash even.
This question will bring us in your article to what you call the central questions in Marx's critique of Proudhonism, which according to you are, what is possible in a capitalist society? What is not possible? And in which ways and to what extent can a capitalist society be different from what it currently is? Can you tell us if there are other texts where this explicit discussion can be found?
Yeah, I think it's the central issue in the Poverty of Philosophy and the critique of Daimon and the critique of the Goethe program. I think the critique of the Goethe program, Marx's opposition to the program, turns on this issue of what's possible, what's not, under what conditions things become possible. I think this issue is also central to the discussion of labor money in the contribution to the critique of political economy and the discussion of the value form in chapter one of Capital. So sometimes Marx is not talking specifically about Proudhonism, but Proudhonism and related tendencies or related tendencies. For instance, the critique of the Goethe program is not about Proudhonism per se, but a doctrine that's kind of close.
Why is it important to ask about possibilities?
Well, if you try to make changes that cannot be made, you're not going to succeed. If you try to make changes without being clear about what it would take to have them succeed and to make sure that that's the precondition, they're not going to succeed. It's all about achieving your goals by means that are actually going to achieve them rather than ones that are not.
You mentioned correspondence on this subject that Marx has with a guy called Pavel Annenkov. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was at the end of 1846. Proudhon had just published this book, Philosophy of Poverty. Marx is right about to start writing in response, Poverty of Philosophy. He writes to Annenkov, and he's commenting on this book by Proudhon. And Marx says that Proudhon, quote, does what all good bourgeois do, close quote. They criticize how competition and other features of bourgeois society exist in practice, but they accept them unquestioningly in principle. Marx writes, what they all want is competition without the pernicious consequences of competition. They all want the impossible, that is, the conditions of bourgeois existence without the necessary consequences of those conditions. So this is all about possibility and impossibility. This was a main theme, so to speak, of Marx's critique in The Poverty of Philosophy, and it continued to be a main theme of his critique of Proudhonism in The Critique of Darimon and so forth, and then critique of a related tendency in The Critique of the Gotha Program.
Is this at all related to what we could call utopianism?
Yeah. Marx refers to John Bray and John Gray. Bray and Gray, and they weren't attorneys at law. They were utopian socialists. One of them advocated a labor money system. One of them advocated an exchange system that wasn't a labor money system. This was before Proudhon. I think Marx thought of them as utopian socialists. There are differences between this Proudhon and Darimon, but there's a family resemblance, and they're all stemming from the same basic notion, which is that what we need is a system of equivalent exchange.
What's the difference between what Marx calls tricks of circulation and what Marx is advocating for?
Circulation refers to monetary circulation, the ongoing exchange of money and commodities. That's what he means by circulation. So it's not just an exchange, like of a product for another product, barter. It's an ongoing process of money exchanging for commodities. That's circulation. I think what he means by tricks of circulation is trying to fundamentally change the character of capitalism by tinkering with the monetary system. He thinks that the problems of capitalism are going to resurface in a different way, as we were talking about. Whatever the specific form of money is, if he changed the nature of money, the same problems will surface, but in a different way, because they're problems inherent in capitalism. They're problems inherent in money itself, whatever its specific form may be, metal or credit or, you know, tokens or whatever it might be. Marx says what's needed is revolutionary transformation of society's mode of production, not exchange, not distribution, production. These other things, exchange, distribution, legal conceptions, all of that, they depend on and flow from what the relations of production are.
Marx does an analogy here regarding the Pope and the Proudhonist theory of money. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about because it helps to flesh out this idea that what's possible, what's not, is a fighting issue for Marx. It's a key theme of all of these critiques. The analogy goes to this. Proudhon, Darimon, they wanted to abolish money. So what do they propose to abolish money? Get rid of the privileged role of gold and silver within the metallic system. You know, only gold and silver are money. Get rid of that. Degrade gold and silver to the rank of all other commodities. That's the way Marx puts it. But if you degrade gold and silver to the rank of other commodities, the flip side of that is you're elevating all commodities to the monopoly position that gold and silver now hold. And so Marx says, let the Pope remain, but make everybody Pope. Abolish money by making every commodity money. And so Marx says, this is in the Critique of Darimon, the question here arises whether this problem does not already pronounce its own nonsensicality, and whether the impossibility of the solution is not already contained in the premises of the question. I think it has to do with the essential character of money. What money is, among other things, is a universal means of exchange. It is something that exchanges for all other things. No other commodity does that. You make some boots, they don't exchange for toilet paper and eggs and cars and trips to the dentist and so forth. But all of those things, none of those things exchange with one another, but all of them exchange for money. So, I mean, you can't have a developed exchange system, except where you have this privileged role of the one thing that's money. One thing that sets money apart is that it's universally accepted in exchange, and really the only thing that's universally accepted in exchange, even credit isn't. You know, you can supposedly buy things on, you know, with credit, right? We all do that. You use your credit card. But you're actually still not paying for them. You have to pay with money. That's what settles your debt, is forking over money. You can't pay credit with credit. And the other thing is, in an exchange relationship, it's an exchange of money for commodity, but they're not like in equal positions, right? Money already in this context seems to be value itself. By virtue of its very being, it is valuable. Like, oh, I have $100. Like, well, how much value do you have? Well, I just told you $100, right? Okay, so it seems to be value itself, and the stuff that it exchanges with seems to acquire its value indirectly by being exchangeable with or worth so much of the money. So money has this privilege, both in terms of being exchangeable for everything and for being like the Pope. You're the head guy, you're infallible, you're always money. But it's got to be one thing that does that. It can't be everything all at once. You can't have all the Catholics be Pope together. You can't have all the commodities be money at once. I want to say one further point. The overriding issue is, could capitalism be different? Could a developed exchange system be any different from, you know, what may have happened historically? And reading the historical record, that alone will never answer the question.
It seems like Marx later in his life returns to the need to revolutionize relations of production in order to make other economic changes possible. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I wouldn't even use the term returns, because that makes it sound like he veered away from it and then came back. And he never veered away from that. This was the dominant, persistent theme of all of his criticisms of Proudhonism and related tendencies. So that's what I'm saying when I say that what's economically possible and what's not was the central issue in all of these critiques. He's saying that the economic changes that these other folks are calling for are not possible unless society's relations of production are revolutionized. Says this in the Poverty of Philosophy, Critique of Dariamon, in the Contribution to the Critique, in Capital, in the Critique of the Goethe Program. This is like a constant theme of his.
Can you really drive home what Marx means by realistic outlook?
Ah, realistic outlook. Yeah. I bring that into my article in connection with talking about Marx dealing with this issue in the Critique of the Goethe Program, which is not about Proudhonism per se, but about something similar. This was 1875. There were two German socialist parties. They united on the basis of this Goethe Program, and Marx opposed the program and the unification on the basis of the program. And the main reason is that the program called for fair distribution or just distribution of income and stuff. It called for that in an abstract way. It made it seem that income distribution was the main issue and a standalone issue. You know, something you could just fix by itself.
Is that what you mean by abstract?
Yeah, it abstracted it from the relations of production and everything else. You know, it just said, okay, let's have fair distribution. It didn't say, let's revolutionize the mode of production so that we can have fair distribution, okay? It dealt with it in an abstract way. So it didn't make clear what to Marx was like hugely important, and that's the main burden of his Critique of the Goethe Program. It failed to make clear that any kind of distribution that's fairer than present-day income distribution becomes possible only on the basis of a revolutionary transformation of society's relations of production. So in connection with this, he says, what they're putting forward with fair distribution and all of that is obsolete verbal rubbish that perverts the realistic outlook, which it costs so much effort to instill into the party, but which has now taken root in it. So when he talks about the realistic outlook, he's not just saying be realistic, he's saying realism about what can be achieved within the present day mode of production, you know, what can be done differently, and it's not much, and realism concerning what we need to do to make a fairer so-called distribution possible, you know, realism concerning the means that will actually achieve these ends.
Something I liked from that quote that you take there that mentions the realistic outlook, he also calls it ideological nonsense about right and other trash so common. And it really speaks to our time as well. We're still having to deal with this thing about right in the abstract from everywhere on the left.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about universal basic income. You don't hear much, you know, universal basic communist relations of production.
Yes, true.
This has been the first half of the discussion between Francisco and myself on Marx's critique of Daryamon in the Grundrisse. We're planning that the next episode of Radio Free Humanity will carry the conclusion of our discussion. So please check for that as well. This has been episode 112 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. Thanks for listening. Please visit MHI's website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, to listen to other episodes, learn more about the issues we discuss, to post comments, and to donate to this podcast series. I'm once again on Sunday, March 17, from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. There will be an MHI Zoom meeting on the recent women's movement in Iran. It's open to the public. If you'd like to attend the meeting, please write to MHI. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.